Hi, welcome to this episode of the Innovation Exchange podcast. In this episode, I first got to sit down virtually with Ben Collins from the King's Fund. Ben's authored an interesting new report looking at technology and innovation for long-term health conditions and how, specifically during the COVID-19 pandemic, health systems have been able to take a leap forward in treatment methods. I also then had a chance to speak to Mo El-Obeidly, founder of Patient Knows Best, one of the case studies that's been featured in Ben's report. I hope you'll enjoy this. Let's go, let's go. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Do you think you could just tell us a bit about yourself and your role at the King's Fund?
Of course. Well, the King's Fund is a charity set up by the King at the end of the 19th century, and our role is to support health and care in England. We carry out research to help improve health and care services. But we also provide support for leadership and organisational development in health and care. I'm one of the researchers in the fund's policy team. My particular interests are in what makes a really high-performing health system, new approaches to delivering care, and the development and spread of innovation.
So the COVID-19 pandemic's really forced health systems to look at new ways of working. I know that as a jobbing GP, my life has pretty much changed drastically overnight in terms of how I consult. And every week we're looking at newer innovations and newer technology and how we can change the way we consult and interact with not just patients, but colleagues. So what can you tell us about your investigation, Ben? What sort of things came to light?
Well, I carried out my research in 2019, and I was starting to write up the findings when COVID hit in the spring of 2020. And I have to say that it really changed my thinking. And I think that COVID has challenged many other researchers' preconceptions about how innovation happens in the NHS. We've got this pretty established narrative about why the NHS struggles to adopt innovations quickly. And research papers, including my own, have listed this range of obstacles to rapid adoption of innovation. So we cite things like a lack of financial incentives to innovate, or resistance by clinicians to innovation, or, you know, an overly top-down system, amongst other things. But over the last 6 months, as I was writing the report, we've seen, of course, really rapid progress. Most obviously moving from face-to-face consultations to virtual services in primary and community care, but also pretty dramatic changes in many hospital outpatient services as well. So clearly these have been quite exceptional times. My sense is we now need to review our thinking on what enables or holds back innovation in the NHS in the light of this. So I'm thinking, can we still insist on the importance of financial incentives if we could make such rapid changes without them? And can we still claim that conservative clinicians are a major obstacle to innovation in the NHS if those same people were able to deliver changes so quickly in a crisis? So in my sense, my work started before this, but my sense is we now have to unpick exactly what happened during COVID to make innovation happen so much faster.
So do you think COVID changed the way we're going to approach such innovations in the future, or do you think it just accelerated our thinking?
Clearly, it focused our minds on a really tangible challenge. And I think probably for the first time in my career in healthcare, everybody at the height of COVID in the late spring was galvanized around a common challenge, a common set of priorities and a common purpose. And that for me is rare in healthcare, which is it's a complex business. And my sense is that some other fundamental things changed as well over the last few months. For example, clearly over this period, the NHS received a different form of support and in some respects greater support than it would have received in the past. So the national NHS paid for digital platforms that that health services would otherwise have to procure on their own. But I also think that something has changed within the decision-making processes within large NHS organisations. In the past, you would need to persuade dozens of different people to support your innovation. Everyone had to say yes, and anyone could say no. Well, my sense is over the last few months, the number of people who could veto a necessary innovation has gone down, and the bar for doing so has gone up.
In my role as CCG chair, you do sometimes see that there are great ideas that are out there, but there's often barriers, and as you've mentioned, some of them, some is finance, some is just basically resistance from GPs, and some of it is information governance, which I've talked about before to many people, and it's helpful, but it also can be a bit of a brick wall that you just can't jump over. And I think that funnels innovations, and it almost distracts a lot of people from getting there. So I think, you know, as you say, COVID has probably transformed the way we look at innovations, and I'm hoping that that's something that's going to stay.
That's the question, isn't it? My sense is that there was a dramatic change for a short period, but anecdotally, I'm hearing that those barriers to more flexible ways of working in general and to adoption of innovation specifically are now starting to creep back. And people are returning to the previous approaches to decision-making within hospitals, for example. And that makes me think that it really is quite critical that we unpick what worked during COVID so that we can crystallize the lessons and say, these are the ways of working that we're actually going to hang on to in the longer term.
So I'm a big fan of the do, fail, repeat cycle, and I think you're right. I think, you know, we're in what the saying is, don't ever waste a good crisis. And I think during COVID, everyone was just in crisis mode, and it was right. You need an innovation, need to do something. Try this, see if it works. And some things worked, some things didn't. And it was really quickly turned around. So over the period of weeks, you'd try something, it'd fail, try something again, and get to the final solution.
For me, there's one of the main barriers to innovation, service innovation in the NHS, has been our approach to the evidence, and a quite embedded belief that the evidence base we should rely on for testing and implementing service change should look broadly similar to the sort of evidence we rely on when deciding whether to introduce a new drug or a new form of medical treatment. But of course, you know, that information rarely exists. You know, the sort of information that you might find on the evidence of statins is rarely going to exist on complex service change. And it might not be particularly useful information even when it does. So for me, one of the positives in all of this has been, I think, a reevaluation of the evidential bar that we need and the sort of evidence we need to test service changes. But I'm also conscious that that does raise some potential risks. You know, we have introduced innovations very fast over the last few months. We've shifted from almost entire face-to-face consultations in primary care to, you know, a large number of primary care practices doing almost all of their consultations online. There's a lot to applaud in all of this, but there are also some questions. You know, can you effectively eyeball a elderly patient, by telephone or on a video call? Will you be able to detect the signs of domestic abuse and be able to alert other services if you no longer visit people in their homes? My sense is that the acceleration of innovation is a great thing. The reduction of obstacles is a great thing, but we do actually also need to go and just question how well the innovations we've introduced during COVID are serving particular groups.
And so then looking at these particular innovations that you've written about in this paper, what sort of lessons do you think we can take from those going forward? So as you say, we don't repeat the errors of the past.
So we looked at four innovations, digital innovations for people with chronic conditions in the UK and the Nordic countries. So we looked at the Patient Knows Best portal in England that you've mentioned, a telecare service for people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease in Denmark, a remote monitoring service for children with diabetes in Finland, and a service in Finland again for connecting people with severe illness with their friends and their support networks. in the support for people with chronic conditions, there are very good arguments that we need quite fundamental change in how we deliver health services. You know, the argument runs that we have adopted an episodic model of care that works well in hospital services, acute hospital services, and applied it to a very different set of conditions. But we have tended to introduce technology in quite conservative ways. We've tended to use digital technology to deliver small improvements within existing ways of doing things, doing our existing tasks a little bit more efficiently rather than really quite radical alternative approaches to care. So what sets these four innovations apart is their radicalism. For example, these services are using digital technology to deliver much more responsive care for people with quite unpredictable and cyclical conditions, rather than seeing everybody every 6 months for an outpatient appointment or following a rigid treatment plan. They demonstrate the power of technology to stitch together different health and care services, allowing staff across primary care, community services, hospital services, social workers, school teachers to work together in a joined up way. And they're using technology to improve the quality of relationships between service users, caregivers, and people's wider support networks. And we know that poorly designed technology can be a huge barrier to effective relationships, with the doctors and nurses glued to their computer screens. But these case studies show that technology can also enable stronger therapeutic relationships. And for example, allowing more regular interaction than is typically possible through face-to-face meetings alone.
What sort of challenges do you think these innovations came across? And is there some that are common to all of them that people can learn from?
So they all encountered a huge number of challenges. And one thing I've found is just how difficult it can be to make even quite small changes in health services. It's a bit like, you know, doing DIY in my Victorian house. If I want to, you know, just connect a TV in a different room, I end up having to pull up the floorboards. And for these types of digital innovation, success often depends on, you know, really quite small details, such as how long does it take for healthcare staff or patients to log in? How hard is it to rectify a small inputting error? How long does it take to get through to the call center if you forgot your password? And for some older people with chronic conditions, they struggle with things that, you know, you might take for granted, like, you know, using an iPad with a touch screen when you've got cold hands and calluses on your hands. Nobody gets all of that right at the start. And one of the key messages from these case studies is the need for iterative cycles of improvement to gain feedback from service users, you know, test what improvements are important to them, and particularly given the challenges that some groups face using digital technology. There were also a bundle of ethical and technical challenges in working out how to transmit, share, and use patient data in ways that secure people's consent, maintain trust, and protect confidentiality. These are far from small problems to address. Our example suggested that part of the solution lies in placing patients firmly in control of their own data so that they decide how it's used and with simple arrangements for opting in and out of data sharing. And if we do that, it helps to inspire trust and establish a more balanced relationship between professionals and service users.
And in terms of impact of these four, do you think there's been a significant impact? And do you think that would have been there irrespective of COVID?
Well, there've been dramatic effects. Let me just take one example for you, the diabetes example. I mean, if you're a parent of a child with type 1 diabetes or a child with type 1 diabetes, well, the effects of that disease can be quite devastating for the whole family. The parents need to monitor their child's blood glucose levels day and night. At night, it's quite hard to know whether your child is sleeping comfortably or is in a coma. Many parents have to stop work, children struggle to participate normally with other children at school. As soon as you introduce a remote system for monitoring blood sugar, well, the family's life no longer revolves around the child's diabetes. So parents can keep tabs on their children's glucose level when they're at work. They can go to bed knowing that if their children need help in the middle of the night, the sensor will wake them up. With live streaming of data, the hospital specialists can focus their efforts on supporting the families who are struggling to manage their children's diabetes, rather than pulling everyone into services for routine follow-ups. And with live streaming of data, it's possible, I think, in the longer term to get much more precise about understanding exactly what triggers a glycemic episode. So in that example alone, the impact has been pretty dramatic. Some of our examples were incredibly rare in that patients were involved before anyone had even got an idea what the innovation should look like. And this was an example in the Huoletti app. And this is an app that allows patients with severe illness to build a support network of family and friends who can stay in contact, offer support, go out and do the shopping, walk the dog, share their own experiences of coping with the illness. And the designers of this app started discussing practical experience of living with severe illness with people before they had even worked out what the solution might look like.
Ben, we've talked about some of the barriers and challenges many of these innovators or innovations came across in trying to set up. And you know, clearly these four have been more successful than some others. So for those that perhaps weren't as successful, or people who are sat in their garage right now, as you suggested, thinking of an innovation, what take-home messages have you got for them from your report?
So the big takeaway really is on the need for greater radicalism in how we use digital technology in healthcare. There's this powerful bias towards conservatism, where we use technology to deliver our existing approaches a little bit more efficiently, but we need to harness the power of technology to deliver services in very different ways. So this work really is a call to arms for entrepreneurs, innovators within clinical services, to be more ambitious in how they deploy technology, in particular for chronic conditions where the deficiencies of existing treatment models are well documented. So I'd encourage entrepreneurs to consider the following things. First, does your digital technology create opportunities to change the nature of care? For example, moving towards more iterative or experimental models of care. For people who often have quite complex and quite idiosyncratic forms of illness. Number two, are there opportunities to harness technology to bring together patients and caregivers in more effective teams? For example, could you bring in mental health practitioners or social prescribers using your online consultations? Three, are there opportunities to use technology to build more effective therapeutic relationships between service users and caregivers? For example, enabling more regular communication between a core group. Four, could you use digital technology to shift the balance of power between service users and caregivers? For example, giving people access to data about themselves and greater control over their care. Five, could you use technology to deliver more holistic care that addresses the psychological and the social aspects of illness as well as the biomedical aspects of illness? And then finally, number six, could you use technology to connect patients with a larger support network, for example, their family, friends, school teachers, social workers, peers, neighbours and volunteers?
Some really useful tips there, Ben. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I hope you found that helpful and useful. And I wish you all the success with your role and to the King's Fund in the future that they're going to lay out for themselves.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was really interesting hearing from Ben, specifically to get an overview of some of those different innovations out there. I then got the opportunity to speak with Mo Al-Ubaidli, the founder of Patient Knows Best. Let's go. Mo, welcome to the podcast. Do you think you could begin by just telling us a little bit about Patient Knows Best?
Hey, sure. Patient Knows Best is Europe's largest personal health records company. We cover 20% of England's population, where we store their records and place the control of each record under the hands of the patient. The system is really around having a complete, real-time, accurate record that follows the patient wherever the patient goes to receive care. And that basically makes care safer and cheaper because you have all the information you need rather than just the information that's in a silo in your local medical record or the subset of data you've had from a previous encounter with the patient.
That's great, Mo. Do you think maybe you could tell us a bit about why you set up Patient Knows Best and I guess what does it actually do?
Sure. So I trained as a physician and programmer. I'm basically a geek. I wrote 6 books about using IT in healthcare. What I enjoy is using new technology and putting it in the hands of users, the people actually doing the work, whether it's a junior doctor or a patient. I always knew I wanted to start a company and the way I was just looking for the most interesting problem. And when I was writing a book about giving patients access to their medical records when I was in the States, I was doing this with my customers who are CIOs, hospital CIOs. And I got really interested in that problem because I personally have a rare disease. It's literally one in a million. When I go and see my doctor, he panics, doesn't know what to do. And I end up telling him what my other doctors did. And I thought that he trusts me because I'd gone to medical school. But when I was writing the book, I realized the real reason he trusts me is that I had gone to all the appointments. That's what a patient does. You become the de facto integrator and historian of what happened to you. And so I then realized from all these examples I was collecting in the USA, how much safer and cheaper healthcare would be if the data was with the patient, if the patient could see all the data, and if they could bring it with them or authorize its use for all of their healthcare delivery. I spent a year explaining this and asking other US hospitals to do what I'd seen from the pioneering deployments, but they weren't doing it anywhere near the scale and the speed that I wanted. This was especially with Microsoft Health Vault and Google Health launching at the time. It was so obvious to me that everyone should be doing this for every person, but they weren't. And as they explained to me their barriers, I thought, I really want this to happen as a patient. I've literally written the book about how to do this, but I can see the healthcare system is struggling in that transition. So if I want this to happen, I need to help out myself. And so I left my job, I left the States and came to the UK in 2008 to start Patients Know Best, partly because all the problems I heard from the USA I thought could be overcome, except one problem, which was around incentives. And I thought the US was actually the worst country to start in, and the UK with the National Health Service was the best country to start in. And if I could prove it there, then we could bring it to every other country. But it had to start from the UK with the National Health Service.
So, Mo, do you think you could tell us a little bit about how the technology actually works? So what does it look and feel like to the end user?
So from a patient's perspective, it's a website that they get invited to by their healthcare provider. When they log in, they see information from the healthcare provider, their letters, their test results, their appointments and care plans. The patient can add anything they want, so they can add their symptoms, their measurements, they can use it to consult online, and they can connect any devices, so a blood pressure cuff, a glucose monitor, a Fitbit with their exercise and sleep patterns. All in one place, they can decide who gets access to that record, and they also already see who's accessed that record. The final component of it is behind the scenes is a two-way programming interface that allows third-party systems to also access that information with the patient's permission. And to me, that's bringing the innovators of healthcare and putting them in the hands of patients. You can connect devices, you can explain information to patients, you can have decision support, analytics, and so on. But at its heart, from a patient's perspective, it's a website they log into that has their data and they decide who gets that data.
Oh, great stuff. And I suppose just as a technical point, whether it's the GP aspect or whether it's the hospital, do patients have access to their full clinical notes as well as the documents and results you've spoken about?
So the patients have access to everything the provider gives them access to. So all of them give the letters immediately and the appointments. And then shortly after that, most of them switch on all the test results, but that one makes clinicians a bit anxious about clinical governance and, you know, making sure the patient can see the data safely, that kind of thing. No one has yet switched on the notes that they take with their patients in the UK, which is a big source of frustration for me, because we know that's highly useful and increases safety. But it's the thing that the doctors are most anxious about. So far they've delayed it in the UK, and they stick to the letters, which is them formally communicating to the patient, or the care plans, where they can show their instructions to the patients.
Sounds like that's something that you might consider, I suppose, for future iterations of the technology. So, Mo, you've been through quite a journey and faced quite a few challenges. What sort of advice would you give to people out there who are just starting out on a similar journey with their innovations?
So honestly, I think there's never been a better time to start, and there's never been a greater need to bring your innovations. I mean, even before the COVID crisis, every major economy, every democracy was struggling with how to maintain universal coverage, that everyone is entitled to healthcare free at the point of need, in the face of increasing costs because people are getting older. That's basically a side effect of the success of healthcare. People don't die with cancer or diabetes. People are having multiple conditions. All this, and there are new treatments and innovations that improve people's lives every day. All that costs more to deliver, and budgets are not able to continue that expansion. So even before COVID, people needed a way to maintain that promise of universal coverage. And the only way to do that is to become more efficient. Healthcare is 10% of every major economy's spending. It can't keep rising, but we do want to help more people. The only way to do that is to become more efficient. And that's technology, basically. That's technology that takes data from the patient's home, that analyzes it, that supports the doctor, that allows doctors to treat more patients more quickly, patients to treat themselves more quickly, more efficiently. And then you had COVID, which really highlighted how important digital is in when you can't be physically with the patient all the time or as often as you are used to. So it's more urgent to have digital. Healthcare needs technology. And on the flip side, on the supply side, there are so many new innovations that are now possible with digital. So I think it's a fantastic time to start. The problem is that healthcare has a slow decision cycle. So you have to pace yourself that you can survive through those decision cycles to prove the value and the safety of what you're trying to do. And then what you can do literally impacts people's lives. It saves people's lives. And it works across entire economies, the whole globe. So it's really satisfying when you can do that. But you've got to figure out how to pace yourself through how healthcare systems work.
Excellent. That's really useful information for people out there about to embark on their own innovation journey, and really heartening to hear the successes as well. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us today, Mo. And I sincerely wish you all the best with PKB.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Really great to speak to Ben and Mo today. I hope you found this episode as interesting as I did. Something that struck me with all the examples in the report is really the important role of multi-agency collaboration, whether these are providers of innovation funds, innovation centres, or development agencies, so that we can create effective partnerships and be more ambitious about innovation. I really hope you enjoyed the episode and wish you all good health at this current time, wherever you may be listening. Speak to you next time.